So it's my pleasure to announce our last speaker of today, and it's Dr. Robert Brennan. Dr. Robert Brennan taught anatomy and several other biomedical sciences for a decade or so before medical school and a career in psychiatry. Recognising that the government's response to the pandemic was anti-science, anti-reality and anti-humane, he joined the Australian Medical Network, formerly known as the COVID Medical Network, as a co-director. He joined the Red Union Amps Group and now TNT Radio. My pronunciation is going to get me again. For the termity of claiming that lockdowns are harmful and the COVID vaccine ought not to be mandated, he lost his registration to practice medicine and was deemed a danger to public health and safety by the regulator. Please help me to welcome Dr. Robert Brennan.
Thank you so very, very much, and my apologies for not having a clicker. But if we just go to the first slide, so I could just gratuitously kind of plug my organisation, so with great thanks also to Cara Thomas and the AMPS, the more awesome part. The COVID Medical Network was Australia's first, largest, hardest hit and hardest hitting dissident doctor network in the country, and in this COVID era, and with members and friends that fall outside just medicine, we have data analysts, we have lawyers, one of our co-directors is a lawyer, we have statisticians, we have all people from all walks of life. But we've called ourselves now the Australian Medical Network with a view to a wider range of issues as we move out of the COVID era and into, well, the fight all the way to Agenda 30 and beyond. I'll talk about that. So there's Australian Medical Network. We move to the next slide. I also want to promote TNT Radio and similar, how should I say, alternate media, dissident media. I have a radio show on Sunday with military lawyer and whistleblower David McBride. And so let's get behind TNT. It's an international radio station. We're going to branch back out into digital TV soon. And it runs 24/7. So if we move to the next slide. Okay, so if we flip through these, we see the physical space. We begin our life. We get baptized. Next. We have our early days at school. And next, we keep on going. We learn, we play. Go to the toy store. Now, this is an interesting one. I know we're going into Goblin's Law by the fifth slide, but at a different time, with a different ideology, with different social pressures, the angle of those arms was a little bit higher. But there's a lot of psychological dynamics that we might say is at play in both cases. Notwithstanding that this is the physical distance and social distancing, there's also the political and ideological distance between us and our fellow men. Okay, so next one. This is Scotland, the land of William Wallace, the land of David Hume.
What?
Rebellious, free-thinking teenagers. On the next slide. We have band practice. This one's from the United States. And if we get through the others, this is a violent gentleman on the beach. And another. This woman's very violent. And another. She did have a potty mouth, but that doesn't warrant a choke and a throw at high velocity on the concrete. Okay. And this gentleman is having some assistance getting his mask on. And next, as is this ultra-violent young woman. She's very serene, actually. Next. This is what a rubber bullet looks like. It gets you there, it might do in your middle meningeal artery and you can bleed to death. And if it does, you're here, you lost an eye. But that's what a rubber bullet contusion looks like. Next, this old man is being assisted in the ways of, well, Wipe it down. It's a lifestyle. Get back home. Next. And this is how we might end our life. This is about as good as it might get. So if we go to the next slide, lest us not forget this past now almost 3 years. This time last year, I was frantically travelling around the country with the two One Nation senators and with Campbell Newman and with a grab bag of others, desperately talking to communities like this before the December 17th mandate, when the likes of us were shut out of venues. And it remained that way pretty well down almost until the federal election. Well, we really showed them. Now, all of these things happened to us. We had Coolangatta Tweed look like a parking lot some days. We had the school closures. Now, remember our former Chief Health Officer, Jeanette Young, is on record for saying, why did she close the schools? She said, because it's not just about the science, it's about the messaging. Right? Because if you keep the schools closed, you've got to keep the parents home, and then they can't defy lockdowns, right? By going out to work. She also said that she allowed certain movie productions into the state, and she allowed sporting events to continue because, well, it's about the economy too. So you have politicians impersonating doctors, and you have doctors impersonating politicians, and it's all just one great blancmange. And she got her reward, didn't she? She had 30 pieces of silver. She's now the governor of the state. We had other things that happened. We had the domestic terminals closed. We had the international terminals closed. Now, we'll presage some of the themes later in my talk when I say that even if you had a country that would receive you, even if there was very little COVID cases in that country, and a plane that would take you, we couldn't leave. Why couldn't we leave? We couldn't leave just because of the diktat as such, but we couldn't leave because it's in our Biosecurity Act that the conditions of exiting this country involve a consultation between federal and the World Health Organization. So you begin to see the instantiations of globalism, even domesticated within federal Commonwealth law. What else do we have? We had the mask mandates. We had Carrie Chant just south of the border, the Chief Health Officer saying, you know, you can't have conversations with your neighbours, don't you? And on and on and on and on and on. We have it, and this is where it gets personal. In Easter of 2020, my wife and our son were just playing on a lonely Gold Coast beach, and the police came up to them, and they said, what are you doing here? You're not doing essential exercise, get home. Now, I knew that there was danger. A year after that, we were defying lockdown. We met with a small gathering, similar place, on Broadwater Parklands. This time, there was not less than 8 cots, 2 paddy wagons. My son was in attendance. They put my wife in an arm lock. They threw her in the back of the paddy wagon. She spent 3 hours at the police station. All explicitly in the name of the Chief of Health Officer and their new truth. They were happy to do that, they were happy to arrest a mother of a child with her child there crying, and they were going to arrest me too. They were going to arrest me too.
They were happy to do that. So when she went back to the station, she looked them in the eye, and this is the benefit of having an ethnically Jewish wife who grew up as a Soviet military child. She looked them in the eye and she said, and what would you have done last century? How far will you go?
To follow orders. That's when they couldn't maintain eye contact. That's when, and there's all these little tells if you bother to look, that's when you know that they're not subject or victim to some mass hypnosis. They're taking the moral easy way out. They're following orders, they're going along to get along because they are operating within constraints that are placed upon them and us by titans of which they are powerless. And it's easier just to do that because they have a mortgage, they have bills to pay, they're just following orders, but they're not hypnotized. Okay, so what did we learn? We have lockdowns, we have all the issues that I used to speak about from 2020 onwards. We have lockdowns that don't work, PCR and cases. You remember PCR and cases?
Yeah.
You can amplify up dead fragments of a virus and you can get a positive case, even though that positive case might not be infectious or sick, might never be infectious, have been infectious or sick, but they're a case nonetheless. Now, in some places, at some times of the world, cases were better defined and PCR had some meaning, hence upon if they medically clinical correlates, etc., etc. But by and large, PCR was to drop and the case numbers were a political exercise. So you've got to understand, and my talk tonight is from a different perspectival approach. If you look at things such as, and I'll sort of go off on a bit of a tangent, if you look at something like teeth whitening, or if you look at something like breast prostheses, you can talk about teeth whitening in terms of the weakening of the enamel, the danger that places upon the gums, how you protect the gums, about the hydrogen peroxide, the effect that has upon the teeth, blah, 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 blah. But it's not about that. Teeth whitening is only 1% medical object, it's 99% psychological and cultural object. No, these phenomena, and there are many phenomena in health and medicine, are not about the biological, they're about the cultural and the psychological. And so it was with all of these issues to which we can critique the COVID cult. We also have mortality with or from COVID. I was on a Zoom meeting once with Sutrid Bhakti, where he described that the first German death from COVID was a terminal esophageal cancer patient and failure of care. But they were positive, and so that was COVID death. We have masks, and then we have the coerced vaccines. But I'll tell you that masks actually work. They work wonderfully. They work as a political object, because they're actually a psychological tool. They're a psychological tool that signals to others that you are either on board with the program or you don't have balls to divide. They're a technocratic Sharia, and that's what they are. And that's exactly why they need to be. Why they introduce them and why they push them in defiance of the established science that they don't work with viruses like this. That's exactly what they did in Northern Hemisphere in the summer, because they needed to bridge from Northern Hemisphere in winter to winter. They needed to have a continuance of COVID consciousness, and that was the way they did it. Okay, so they were wrong on everything. And you have to ask yourself, if someone or someone's are wrong on everything, did they ever intend to be right on anything? No. And so now we skirt close to being conspiracy theorists.
Okay. Oh no!
All I'll say now, once again, take a perspectival approach to see things from different lenses and how we might approach things in discourse with others. It's an interesting observation that if I was to say to the mainstream people, you know, you've got some jihadis that can fly planes into a building. They conspire to that end. Okay, people accept that, that's fine. China, in its espionage and its statecraft, which it's undoubtedly involved in, it conspires. We're fine with that. The Nazis, the Soviets, they conspired. We could say that the Vikings, that they conspire, in so much as there's an organised crime system that works on the Gold Coast, Thailand. I know a lot about that because psychiatric patients have come my way who have been falling afoul of the wrong people. And all of that's conspiracy. If some mothers in the western suburbs of Sydney get together a few daycare centres and sort of make up some kids that don't exist in order to defraud Centrelink, that's a conspiracy. And it's very, very interesting that it's permissible to believe in conspiracy theory when though the protagonists are back then, over there, common folk, people of low social currency, but not megalomaniac billionaires, not globalist corporations, not our own government. That's not permitted. It's very, very interesting. Okay. Another thing I'd like to say is that well, it's very good to have scientific arguments, it's wonderful. But science is the handmaiden of ethics. Ethics is upstream from science. And many of the problems that we face nowadays could be dealt with quite easily by engaging with ethical argument. You want to refuse a vaccine, you say, well, it's not safe and it's not effective. But what if they design one that is safe? What are you going to do then? What if you were to say, well, I have my certain criteria in a man or a woman, and your friends get together and they get that man or they get that woman and they say, look, it meets your criteria. You must go out with him, you must marry with him, you must consummate that marriage, but you say, I'm not really interested in that. But why not? It's safe and effective, so to speak. It meets your criteria, so to speak. You see, we have to understand that the choice is something that is paramount. The choice is upstream.
Yes.
And if you feel that you need to give a defense, oh, well, and you need to go searching for studies, oh, well, you know, does it prevent transmission? Oh, is it going to cause this adverse effect? They're already in your head.
Yeah.
It means that in you've introjected the technocratic, biopolitical, post-utilitarian state of affairs where you have to give a biological defense for your ethical choice. When really, you ought to be able to say, my no means no.
Yeah.
And if I give you a reason, it is by my good grace. And I have. And that's that. So, and it's the same thing with all of you. Okay. Now, we might say, they might say, oh yes, but we didn't know what was going to happen. In February the 18th, 2020, they were ready to rock and roll with this document. Now this was February the 18th. This was before a single Australian death. The first Australian death was an ex-passenger of the Diamond Princess. This is when there weren't that many deaths outside of China, and we were mainly relying on propaganda that came out of the CCP, okay? But they were ready to rock and roll with this document. Isn't that interesting? And between February and March, every country threw away their existing pandemic plans, called for exactly the opposite of what they ended up doing. Very, very interesting, the timing, the coordination. And in this particular case, they said quite arbitrarily, well, we're identifying three potential tiers of pandemic light, medium, heavy. And we're going to assume that this is a medium one. What does a medium one mean? It means that we're going to activate and expand states of emergency legislation. We're also, they committed themselves way back then, that they're going to go for the vaccine. Right? They said, well, we don't really know if we'll succeed, but we're going to go for it. And so when they did that, combined with your 2 weeks of flattening the curve, blah, 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 I knew that they were going to go all the way. They also appealed to some, well, poorly coherent ethical principles that occupy about a third of a page, where in this document you have 5 full pages devoted to public relations. It says it all. Okay. If we go to the next slide, and here's the Diamond Princess that I speak ad nauseum about, right? The index patient got off, I think, at Hong Kong on the 25th of January. It was interned at Yokohama Bay on the 3rd of February. 3,711 souls on board. By and large, an elderly population. That's kind of cruise ships for you. And the maximum admixture of people and the maximum contagious potential in this floating petri dish. And what did you end up having? Now, at the time, and fair enough, you're going to say, well, in the first 4 to 6 weeks, that's when you count your sort of deaths from index case to get an idea of how lethal the virus is. In the first 6 weeks, you had about 7 deaths. They try and stretch it out and say, anybody who died who had COVID on the ship, even on way out in the late April, well, we'll count them. So they try and make it about 14. But let's split the difference, let's say about 12. So 12 out of 3,711. What does that give you? That gives you 99.7% population survival rate, right? We knew how lethal this virus was in the worst case scenario right from the beginning. But you know what they did? It was, in the Australian context, it was the 19th of March when the Ruby Princess came into Sydney Harbour under a Liberal Premier with a Liberal Prime Minister who was there in the inner circle when Howard got all these kudos for stopping the votes. Now, I'm not going to say that they have the intelligence to actually work deliberately on the psychological priming to play upon those sentiments, but that's what happened. You know, you have a demographic scourge coming down out of Indonesia, and they know the public sentiment. You have a viral scourge coming off the Ruby Princess. That's when Australia really went bananas. They should have just said, let them off. Who cares, right? And follow a Great Barrington Declaration strategy of focused protection against the elderly. And I might add, the Great Barrington Declaration only, how shall I say, ethically vindicated itself in the final line of the final paragraph when it said that the elderly should be given focused protection if they wish. That means that if the elderly want to stay in the place they have life left, with the life that is theirs and the body that's their own, if they want to go out and risk it, they can. Why? Because it's their choice, right? So, okay, next slide. All right. Now, they could say, oh, but they were in a panic. We hear this all the time. Oh, Boris Johnson panicked. Why? Because his advisor said that there were some excess deaths in nursing homes and he was afraid of being in the headline. They all panicked, you see? None of these people coordinate. None of these people have ill will. They just were victims of their own sympathetic nervous system. Well, the problem is that they don't get panicked. They give panicked.
Yeah.
There is the Nudge Unit with David Halpern, which officially started David Cameron administration in 2010. But Halpern is actually one of the chief lieutenants of propaganda policy under the Blair regime at a time when Comrade Jacinda Ardern, the former head of the International Socialist Youth, was doing an internship. You see how you get all these connections, right? Now, what do they say? They say that we're going to use fear, and they appeal, because they've got to use references, they're academics, to threatening communication, a critical reanalysis and revised meta-analysis, analytic test of fear appeal theory. They did it deliberately, right? They did it deliberately. And those of you who know something about nudge theory and about sort of psychological manipulations, let's say, and about the propaganda machines and about marketing strategies will see chapter. If we go on to the next slide. Okay, and here's Sweden. In absolute numbers terms, running on up to 2020, you can't see excess mortality. If we go to the next slide. If you go to the next slide, this is adjusted for population. So if you adjust for population, you'll see that there's a general trend down, probably because we have the Northern African young males who moved up asylum seekers. And so it causes the average age to drop a little bit over the years. But still, the 2020 deaths per million people are identical to 2012 and pretty well identical to 2013. The only, you'll notice that there was in 2019, there's a bit of a drop. Swings and roundabouts. You know, nature's like that. You'll get some elderly, you'll get some infirmed, you just got lucky. But death swings around and claims them the next year. And that's exactly what happened. So if we have next. Okay. So then you have the likes of the data-driven economist Emily Oster from Brown University. And she says, hey, you know, we're moving at the speed of science. We didn't know. There was so much uncertainty. You know, they didn't want to know. They didn't want to know. And now, lower tier elites like her, where she teaches a course in COVID at Brown, well, now they're probably thinking, oh, well, you know, you probably didn't get it right. She wanted to claim amnesty. No amnesty. No amnesty. Why? Because Actions, they knew, and actions have consequences. And we need to attach a message to an arrow and fire it into the future. You do the crime, you do the time. So yes.
And they're going to do the
time. Okay, but is it over? It's over. We can travel, blah, 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 blah. No, it's not over. No, it's not over. The analogy I like to use is that our seven-year-old is a mixed martial arts kind of little kid, right? And I've rolled with his jiu-jitsu instructor. And when his jiu-jitsu instructor has me in a hole and then he releases it, I know I'm in trouble because I know he's repositioning and the next one's either going to break my arm or I'm going to be choked out if I don't tap out. Right? So that's what they're doing. They're just taking a pause, reloading the weaponry. They've learned a hell of a lot of lessons. They learned a huge one on the weekend in Pretoria. They learned how compliant a population can be and what they can get away with. And what are they doing? Let's move up from local. Now the Chief Health Officer of Queensland, he can determine what occupational classes have vaccine mandates. He can call a mask mandate anywhere, anytime for anybody, right? He has lost the power to close the state borders. Well, that's a victory. No, it's not, because that flow of power is now flowing up to Canberra, right? The power and the money in this last couple of years and in the strategy to come is flowing upwards and outwards. Okay, so then we have the Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Act that went through without a problem, with full support of the Liberal opposition here in Queensland. The only real opposition that got it were a few counterparty people and the One Nation member, Steve Andrews, right? The rest were quite happy to let it go through. What are they doing in this new National Health Regulation Act? It's now passed. Okay. One thing they're doing is this, is that if you're a practitioner under investigation, they can name and shame you to your current colleagues and employers, your past colleagues and employers, and that's going to have a terrible chilling effect. Because health practitioners in general and doctors in particular are terrified. They're terrified. There's 110,000 registered medical practitioners in this country at last census. And I remember in the dark days of early 2021, there were probably about 10 of us in the whole country that were speaking up, you know. They're terrified, and they should be, you know, because there's a lot to lose, you know, like anybody, right? And they can, as they did with me, as they did just before me, I got the silver medal, call us to House, and Ethan just got gold for being the first to be knocked out for disinformation, so to speak. But that'll have a chilling effect. Another thing that they're doing is this. You know, you've got all these people that are saying, well, we're going to form private member societies, we're going to form parallel systems, we're going to get off the grid, we're going to still be healers, but we're going to do it without ACCA. Well, they've decided, no, if you were ever registered with us, you'll always be subject to our disciplinary actions. So that's another change. Right? They've also changed their guiding principles. And this is where you've got to decode the language. Their principal objectives as regulators will be the protection of the public health, right? And also the public confidence. What does that mean? That means that it's not an individual and their health. It's not like the anaesthetist sort of, you know, pilfered the drug cupboard and didn't pull the patient under enough, the surgeon took out the wrong kidney, the psychiatrist slept with the patient who was a vulnerable young woman, da da da. Now, it's not about individual clinical acts of negligence or less. No, it's about this obstruction that's the public, right? But who's the public? Where's the public? The public is an abstraction because it's like a Maoist goal, you know? We're going to protect the public, we're going to protect the public health, and we're going to further its objectives, even if it kills everyone, even if everybody's miserable. Now, the other thing is that the public confidence. Confidence, well, what does that mean? That means that, well, you've got to have a uniformity of messaging. Because if you have dissident doctors, dissident nurses, dissident LIL, then the public might think, well, wait a minute, there's two different messages here. I don't think for myself, they're not really all on the same page. Maybe that means that someone can be wrong. That's not permitted for them to be wrong, because they've got to be a professional elite class where they're always right and they're always speaking the message. And so the public confidence angle is one of basically saying, you've all got to work in lockstep or we'll shut you down. Okay, what else have we got? We have Australian CDC. Australian CDC, they're going through consultation now. They released their paper this month. They're only giving a month for a public consultation, and we know what this sort of consultation processes are like. They don't care what you think, they don't care what you write in, they don't care what you submit, they've already decided. And on page 33, it states that they have, they, broadly speaking, have aspirations to fold them, first of all, to subsume all the infrastructure of Australian public health. They're not going to operate parallel, they're going to capture. And then they're going to subsume that and be subsumed within the World Health Organization, right? Okay, so that's the Australian CDC. Now, we'll just sort of move over to things such as the C-Cities report. Now, Sadiq Khan, I think, is still the head of that. The C40 are the largest, most populous cities in the world, include Sydney, include Melbourne, and their plans are a model for smaller cities, the regions, and the towns, right? And they're planning things such as, well, you know, private ownership is not such a great thing, and our goal is to have only one person in 10 that owns a vehicle. Our goal is that you have 300 grams of meat maximum per person per week. That's not a lot of meat, but the ideal is to go full vegan. Forget about your long-haul travel. Their goal is that you have one short-haul flight per person for 3 years, but they're kind of like, they'll accept it once every 2 years, where short-haul is defined as 1,500 kilometres. That's what they're looking at. They're looking at a brave new world. Okay, and so then we have Bali, the G20 met in Nusa Dua. And now that's it. Now the interesting thing is, if you don't have the country's delegates go meet up at Bali and then come back, and then make sovereign decisions as leaders of their own countries and delegates of their own countries and release position statements representative of the country that went to Bali. No. The consensus is given by the White House that represents all of the 20 delegate countries that attended. And with acknowledgements at the end for your Gates front organisations such as Gavi and CEPI and the World Economic Forum, you had Klaus Schwab there, So the power and the money is flowing up and out. Then we have the WHO, the pandemic treaty. Their discussion started in spring, thereabouts, last year, and they've got the next big meeting that they're having, rolling meetings. They're going full tilt on this. The next big meeting is next week, and they're looking at rolling out their grand plans by 2024. What are their grand plans? It's basically that there'll be a uniform pandemic instrument that will determine when a pandemic is called, what measures are taken, and that there will be all of the 194 member states operate in lockstep according to that instrument and under the executive of the World Health Organization, right? Now, the money will also flow out of all the different member countries in order to finance this. And what that means is that, well, they can just say that the whole world will become like Victoria at its worst, right? And 194 countries will do it. And you can forget about democracy, you can forget about your own wishes about the rule of law in the country. Of course, they all provide some lip service to this sort of thing. But that's the danger. And if I was back in the 90s, I'd say, they're just wanting to make sure that everybody was clean water, and everybody controls the mosquitoes, and nobody's left behind. But we know now what they're all about. Okay, so it's not over. Don't believe it. Next one. Okay, what is it really about? What's some of the ways in which we can look at this? Now, I'm a big fan of Thomas Szasz, and Thomas Szasz coined the term and put up the idea of it as the therapeutic study with respect to the excesses of psychiatry, right? So if you have somebody who's problematic, right, and their activities in the community fall outside of the criminal code, well, how do you manage them? How do you control it? Well, you make them sick, you cure them. That's what can be the excesses of psychiatry. And we saw that, for example, all of the Western psychiatrists are fond of pointing the finger over there at Soviet psychiatry and saying, well, there was this thing called Soviet schizophrenia. For those of you who didn't have the cognitive capacities, insight, and didn't accept the perfection that is socialism, well, you must be sick in the head and we must hospitalize you and must treat you. So you see, anything that is, how shall I say this, anything that is dissident, deviant, can be medicalized and can be controlled. And it might start with the excesses of psychiatry, and it's happened in the COVID space. We know several people in our circles in Europe who were subjected to involuntary hospitalisation of psychiatric assessment when they were perfectly sane. It's happened in Canada, right? So we know that it happened. But what's the end to it? What's the end? Everything can become a health fad. Everything can become a health fad. I can argue that, based upon good science, that if you subject a child or an adult to trauma, that there are sort of essentially neurotoxic events that happen in the brain, right?
Okay.
Well, we can say that mean words are neurotoxic. That politically incorrect speech is neurotoxic. We can say that therefore this must be controlled. We can say that, and the World Health Organization is using this rhetoric with their One Health approach, their global governance of One Health approach, that the planet is like an organism. Its health is important. Of course, its health is important. But what does that mean? That means that if your activities are such that it goes against the climate change agenda, well, it impacts upon the health of the planet and indirectly impacts upon the health of other people, and so you are in control. Right? And so you can see the directions in which this is going. You can also see that, and how's my time? Okay. That we have well and truly entered into the technocratic space. So what is technocracy? It's various ways of looking at it. But I would define it thus. This exoteric technocracy. If you're an elite, that's running the show, you obviously think yourself superior to the average man. You obviously have control over it. You're the brain and the earth is the body. And the various inorganic and organic elements of the earth are the cells of the body, including humans, right? And so what does a good brain need? What does a good brain need? It needs to have a system of nerves that feed into it, telling it what the body is up to. It needs afferent nerves to tell it what's happening. That's just surveillance. So it needs to have its finger on the way that exoteric technocracy works. Of course, much of the motivation we can only speculate on. It is at bare minimum those who think themselves better than you, who want to maintain power, and they're humans, and they want to maintain power in order to obtain power itself and also profit. But also, there are some characters like Yuval Noah Harari, who have much more glorious ambitions. That's where esoteric technocracy comes in. Explicit, that they want to create for themselves, of course, not for you, a transhumanist world. They want to incorporate within themselves genetic modifications, technological modifications, so that they can become gods. So even atheists like Yuval Noah Harari, they play upon what they would consider the mythologies of old. They want to return to Eden. They want the earth to be Eden. They want to live forever. They want to fly over these vistas of forests and waterfalls and their electric planes and be, well, Adam was originally immortal. So somewhere between Adam as the name of things or the god and God. That's what they want to do. And as I say, it might be only a minority. The rest are just bound by base motives of power and profit. And legacy. They want to give it off to their kids. So the question that I have is this, and I'm probably speaking to a conservative audience, is that they exercise a precautionary principle during COVID. They said, you have to lock down, you have to mask up, because you might catch the virus and die. But what's the chances, applying a precautionary principle in a different direction, that I'm right? What's the chances that we're staring down the barrel of the 2030, 2024, in the case of COVID, 2030, 2040, 2050, that we're looking on out at a world where, as I say, you, everywhere you go, everybody you're with, every association, every transaction, tracked, controlled, and it becomes a world where, and this is in Ashley Sutton, this is contra those good guys always win, okay? The good guys always win. But when you have the whole of the world captured under this globalist technocracy, with the aid of technology and globalization, they can bring on the end of history. We saw it throughout COVID. I was on this talk with, I remember, I was on this talk with Ivan Cummins, and I'd done the math, and I was thinking, okay, if I learn how to sail, I can sail out to Vanuatu for 3 days. It would take me 3 days out to Vanuatu, but they're part of the COVID cult. It'll take me 30-odd days to get, if I could somehow survive it, to get to Mexico. But what if Mexico flips? There can be a future where there's nowhere to run, where there's no Israel for us, where there's no Americas for us. So in that sense, I understand the body count is much lower. I don't want to, dishonour the loss of lives to the terrible regimes of the 20th century. In a sense, we've got it a lot easier. But in a sense, it's a lot worse. Why? Because they had somewhere to run to, and we might not. So if we just move on to the next. Okay. Okay, so there are different remedies that we can employ. One is a different application of the precautionary principle. The other is to understand the friend-enemy distinction. We have to, I really applaud, and I guess the Christian way would be to turn and achieve, etc. No, I get that. But we have to understand if a boy meets a girl, and they meet at a record store, and he's looking at reggae and she's looking at classical, and they have a disagreement. I don't like your music, or I don't like your music, but they have some chemistry, right? So then they go play tennis in the afternoon. And he beats her one set, she beats him one set. Okay, they're kind of a bit with that, but then they go to dinner. And then she says, well, he says, well, you know, these anti-vaxxers, the conspiracy theorists, they ought to be controlled, they ought to be locked down, they ought to be put in prison. If they have a kid, well, they're not fit to parent, they shouldn't have their kid taken off, etc. And he says, well, what did you do yesterday? She says, well, I didn't process much. You know? We've got to realise that there is, in the morning there's a difference of opinion, in the afternoon they were sporting opponents, in the evening something else happens, right? If you have issues where there's one will be victorious and one will suffer greatly, if that does result in kind of kinetic brutality, we call it war. If it's on the edge of that, we call it politics. And that's what is happening. We've got to understand there is such a thing as the friend-enemy distinction. And we've got to accept it. We've got to accept that there are people who hate you, who will not see eye to eye with you, and they want to destroy you. and you can't be friends with them, and they don't want to be friends with you. It's something that, I know it's a liberal code, oh, everybody should be friends with us, it's a distraction, because while we want to be friends with everyone, they're wanting to destroy us. Okay, and you don't be, I explained this earlier with respect to vaccines, you never be defensive, you always be over offensive. Because offense is the best defense. They call you a conspiracy theorist, you call them a naive theorist. You know, and so on and so forth. Next one. Let me finish then. Okay. And I want to mention another thing. If we just, I might be able to come back to this. How's the time? Okay. I just want to flip forward to, because there's something very important. Okay. States of emergency are, once again, different perspective. We are, I think, accustomed to thinking that there is normal democracy, there is proper application of the rule of law, and then occasionally things happen where there's a blip, and that's a state of emergency, a departure from the norm. But there's another way of looking at it, and that way of looking at it is this, that normal politics and normal law is what happens when those with power to do differently choose not to exercise it, right? And when democracy and rule of law gets in the way, that's when they, by pretense of a state of emergency, do what they want to do. And that the defining feature of real power is the exercise of a state of emergency. And this is why Schmitt said, sovereign is he who can decide upon the exception. Because the defining feature of the political structures within which you live is who can say this time is different, for how long it's different, what they will do, and when they will end it, right? That's what a state of emergency is. And it's interesting if you take a historical survey from the Americas and the French Revolution on up, with modernity and the foundings of democracy, you start to find the use of the state of emergency by various names and various expansions. And Germany, between the two wars and before Hitler claimed power, had declared state of emergency 200 times. We have America in a perpetual state of emergency, right? So I would argue that the potentiality within a state of emergency is so dangerous that it ought not to be reformed. We can't call for its reform, but rather its abolition. I was in Tathra and Bega at the time of the first fires, when 15% of homes in Tathra were wiped out and much of the regions. Nobody needed to declare a state of emergency then. The public, organically, common sense, they recognised the dangers, they activated themselves, they came together as a community. They didn't need anything more than that. We need to trust the community, and we need to abolish states of emergency. We also, just to close, because I run out of time, this quote, it is essential that man is not to be compelled to have recourse as a last resort to rebellion against tyranny and oppression, that human rights should be protected by the rule of law. That is not something by the founding fathers of the USA, it's not by some right-wing group, that comes out of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the UN in 1948, and it was repeated in Syracuse in 1984, when they spoke of the derogations and the limitations to civil and political rights in states of emergency, and there's a recurring phrase that's used, and Australia was a signatory of that document that was published in 85, a year later. And that is that you can only limit civil and political rights at all if there is a threat to the life of a nation. It's never a threat to the life of a nation. Not in the Diamond Princess, not in Australia. But what we need to do is we need to think, well, this is actually giving license to rebellion because they stepped over the line. Now, I'm not inciting to violence. I'm not inciting to rebellion, but what I'm doing is I'm saying that just as we need to go further out to draw on the energies of the far right and the far left, so I cancel out the middle, we call them common sense people, but we need to think further, not just to the reform of states of emergency, but also to not inciting to violence, but inciting to a conversation about inciting. We need to have a national conversation so that we can say what our limits are, and if they step out of that line, we have all a common understanding, we will step out over that line to meet them. We need to go that far. Why? Because I'm back to what happened to us and what might happen to us still. And so, yes, we're out of time, so thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brennan, as well.